Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria. Good afternoon. You are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. The Young Turks decided to eliminate an entire ethnic group that lived alongside them within the Ottoman Empire. The Armenian genocide, in which some 1.5 million Armenians were systematically killed, is considered the first of the 20th century by many scholars. Ostensibly, the Armenian genocide informed Adolf Hitler's quest to eliminate the Jews decades later. And despite calls to never again let such atrocities occur, governments have continued to annihilate their own people, including the 1994 Rwandan genocide, in which some 800,000 Tutsi people were systematically and brutally killed in only 100 days. Why do genocides happen? What are the conditions for genocide? And how can they be prevented in the future? We have with us Alex Hinton. He is executive director at the Center for Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is a professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and the first vice president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars. He's authored numerous books, including the award-winning Why Did They Kill? Cambodia and the Shadow Genocide. And he has six other edited or co-edited collections. Professor Vahakan Dadrian is director of genocide research at the Zorian Institute. He's been a professor of sociology at the State University of New York and was director of the genocide study project sponsored by the H.F. Guggenheim Foundation, which published the history of the Armenian genocide, ethnic conflict from the Balkans to Anatolia and the Caucasus. He's also authored German Responsibility in the Armenian Genocide, Warrant for Genocide, and Key Elements of the Turkish Denial of the Armenian Genocide. We also have with us Dr. Richard Hrayar Dekmedjan. He's a professor of political science at University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's also the founder and director of USC's Institute of Armenian Studies. He's written numerous books. It includes the latest Spectrum of Terror, as well as earlier books such as The Patterns of World Leadership. His specialties include world leadership, terrorism, and genocide. So welcome to all three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Given the date and the anniversary that is upon us of the Armenian genocide, I'd like to start with that particular occurrence in history. Vahakan Dadrian, let's have you begin with what happened in 1915 and why it still matters today.
I think the most significant feature of the Armenian genocide is that it was World War I period, the context for atrocities all over the world on a global scale, and the Ottoman perpetrators took advantage of the opportunity afforded by this global war. Secondly, the men folk in the category of 20 to 45 years old, all men, Armenian men folk, were conscripted by the Ottoman army, thereby creating a huge mass of Armenian women and children in utmost vulnerability to victimization. To understand the Armenian genocide at this into a relationship with the Jewish Holocaust, that both genocides were perpetrated by the opportunities afforded by a global war.
Richard Dekmedjan.
I've been laboring with a book of mine about the leadership factor in five genocides, and specifically in the Armenian and the Holocaust cases. I look at the war itself and the previous period of crisis in these societies, both the Ottoman and the Ottoman Turkish and the German. And during those crises, you have what I call marginal men, men from the margins of that society, coming in and gaining supreme power, and then targeting a community, a particular community, Armenians and Jews respectively, and exterminating them as some kind of an ideological imperative, because these people tried to be the super Turk and the super Germans, in a sense, to justify their claim to power. Therefore, these minorities were victimized as a result of that.
When you say ideological imperative, you mean that these particular ethnic groups were in the way of some ideology?
These ethnic groups were in the way of a grand design, as President Dadrian, of course, illustrates so many times in his works. In the case of the Turkish case, you had the pan-Turanist imperative, the dream of establishing a Turan, pan-Turkish empire from Constantinople, from the Balkans all the way to Central Asia, and that the Armenians and other Christians, but particularly Armenians, geostrategically were in the way. It corresponds to the German notion, the Nazi notion of Lebensraum. whereby there were Jews particularly, but as well as other communities, Poles, Ukrainians, Gypsies and homosexuals and so on, were targeted as undesirable people for not only in terms of eugenics, but also in terms of their existence in Central Europe, where the German race needed Lebensraum, living space, and therefore they had to be destroyed.
Alex Hinton.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to thank my colleagues for their remarks. I might take a slightly different tack. In terms of the meaning and the importance of the commemoration, I think that the theme of denial has to be set in the forefront. The case of the Armenian genocide being denied by the Turkish government is something that effectively flags for everybody else. It's okay to perpetrate a genocide. You can just try and deny it afterwards. And in another sense, denial is linked during the actual process of the genocide to the genocidal process. So in a sense, the denial continues the genocide. And in fact, if you think about it, you have the first death of the victims, which takes place during the genocide itself. The second death is a symbolic social one that takes place through a campaign of denial. So on the day that the Turkish government and the international community recognizes the Armenian genocide clearly, that will be an important moment and a statement to everybody that it's not appropriate to deny genocide, you can't do it, and that will not be tolerated.
Let's bring Vahakan Dadrian back in. Now, the Turkish government says that what was actually occurring was a civil war. And their remarks are generally that Armenians were also killing Turks. What actually did happen?
In order to understand the persistence of Turkish denial, we have to understand the conditions that afforded such a denial. Therefore, I like to come to a major issue characterizes the Armenian genocide. In fact, it distinguishes itself in terms of most other genocides of the 20th century, and that is the impunity afforded the Turkish perpetrators. Prior to the Armenian genocide of World War I, in the 1890s, particularly 1894 and 1896, the Ottoman government perpetrated massive scale of massacres in the Armenian provinces. Approximately 200,000 Armenians were massacred in broad daylight in a period of 3 consecutive days. There was no punishment, no trial, no condemnation from either inside or outside Turkey. There were protests, but that was it. And I believe that this impunity of 19th century massacres was a major contributing factor in the decision-making of the genocide of World War I. When impunity is afforded to the perpetrators, certain psychological development take place in the frame of mind of the perpetrators. Number one, they begin to take the atrocities for granted. It facilitates denial of the crime, and as a result of it, the perpetrators and their heirs become defiant historically and otherwise, and as a result, a zeal develops to repeat the crime when opportunities present themselves, and there's still another conflict with the victim group. The problem of impunity is a major factor in the analysis of genocide in general, because one of its general byproducts, apart from the particular victim and the particular perpetrator, that it tends to become contagious for other future perpetrators. I believe that if the Armenian genocide was criminally prosecuted and entailing massive punishment and retributive justice, I would hesitate to say that the Nazis would be emboldened to proceed to the campaign of Jewish Holocaust. And I think this is best illustrated by the statement attributed to Adolf Hitler, who in 1939 reportedly, to assuage the concern of some German generals who were being advised that the Polish nation has to be destroyed, they said, "Don't worry, who remembers the Armenian genocide?"
This is the Adolf Hitler quote. After all, who remembers the Armenians that justified that he could continue on his killing rampage? So what you're saying is that it's quite possible that the Armenian genocide, through its lack of prosecution, was giving birth to the future genocides. And that is one of the significant elements and one of the reasons why recognition and acknowledgement of these things and prosecution is so important. Richard Dickmedjian, you've looked at a broad swath of genocides and looked at these analytically. What are the conditions?
A society in crisis, usually in the case of the first two, certainly, where the world is, you know, involved in two major wars. But the crisis environment is very important in any case, because the crisis environment gives rise to a certain kind of génocidaire, they use the French word, certain pathologically inclined people who come from margins of society and grab power and use it brutally. And then there are other factors such as the ideological imperative. These people have a program to implement, which they justify ideologically to their followers. Then, of course, they, beyond the grabbing power, they have to have a mechanism, like the Teşkilat-ı Mahsuse in the case of the special organism, in the case of the Turks and the Schutzstaffel and the other organizations, in the case of Nazis, and you see them in every one of these recent genocides as well, an elite that specializes in killing, mass killing, programming, and all of those factors. And last but not least, lack of external intervention. As the professor pointed out, the Turks got away with it, and many of the so-called young Turks, the jihadists, lived to prosper, and some of them took leading positions in the Kemalist regime, in the so-called secular Turkish Republic under Atatürk. So when people get away with that kind of mass killing, it happens again. That's why the International Court is so important. And that's why it's important to recognize these genocides. As the president is getting ready to speak on his major campaign tour, there'll be thousands of Armenians and others demonstrating, because the president, you know, has been, of course, very explicit about the Armenian genocide. But once he became president, he is afraid to use the G word, genocide word, precisely because the Turks warned him against it.
I'd like to continue on this path for just a second about these conditions for genocide. And I guess we should also use the word politicide, which brings Professor Hinton back in. You interviewed the perpetrators as well.
Yeah, you know, I also think it's important to point out that I don't find the term politicide particularly useful. The you know, it derives from the UN Genocide Convention, which came out and protected four groups at the expense of many others. And again, it was mainly through political bargaining and the entrance of the different delegates at the UN who were debating this. So effectively, you know, I and many other scholars view genocide as an attempt to destroy and hold or in part another group of human beings. And so I tend not to use terms like politicide. It's a genocide. So having said that, in terms of this question of both the preconditions for genocide and the process of perpetrator motivation, which are both things I explore in my book, Why Do They Kill? I would just add to the comments that Professor Dickmedjian said that there's also, you know, the question is, why do people follow leaders who espouse a message of hate? It's not a straightforward process. It's a difficult thing to do. And all of these different situations, the leaders have to come up with an ideology that fits and meshes with local understandings that are meaningful to people. In the case, if we want to switch over, for example, to Cambodia, you know, the Khmer Rouge had to play upon Buddhism, which it had already banned, but to use Buddhist idioms because they were resonant with the peasants, many of whom had gone into the pagoda for many years. So it's actually, you know, it's a difficult thing to motivate people to do these things. And I think it's important not to simply say, well, a perpetrator, a regime comes in and they simply order people to go kill. People are ready and willing to do so, and it proceeds in a straightforward manner. There are different sectors of society, and there are different echelons of people. People vary in their motivations. And it's very important in terms of thinking, for example, of combating genocide, to be aware of these different domains in which, if, for example, if dehumanization or certain rituals of degradation are operative to combat, we have to know and understand what's going on these local levels. And it's absolutely critical also in the long term to think about this. Again, we have a thing where we think of genocide beginning and ending. Genocides continue into the future. I would argue that the Armenian genocide continues into the present. I would argue that the genocide against Native Americans, which is also denied and unrecognized, continues into the present. It becomes something that's structural, it links to cultural genocide, and the denial is one more phase in that. So again, you know, in some ways, I think scholars need to rework their understandings of these different things. And I should also note that, for example, we had a conference here last month on forgotten genocides, and the sort of part of the theme of it was to think about how structures of power and knowledge also shape not just public perception, but also the perception of scholars. And I should say, first of all scholars, the vast majority of scholars acknowledge the Armenian Genocide, and that should be known. It's been acknowledged by the International Association of Genocide Scholars. But the way we look at events, we look at some events and we talk about them and we forget about others. And this conference explored that. Native Americans were one group that's been largely forgotten. The Ukrainian Genocide, the Circassian Genocide, there are many other examples in history. And so I think all of us, again, in terms of combating denial and forgetting, need to rework the way we think about these things. I think it's absolutely critical, along with actively combating denial, such as that espoused by the Turkish government.
You named several genocides that have been forgotten, and the Armenian one probably would be forgotten if it not for some scholars such as yourself and the Armenian community itself. What are the politics behind forgetting or non-recognition?
Forgetting, in a sense, is linked to denial. If you see also the notion that once something's forgotten, no one talks about it. So effectively, it has the same effect as being denied. There are very specific political reasons for denying, horrible things have happened in the past. First of all, you may be criminally liable, especially after the passage of the UN Genocide Convention, right? It also, in terms of the international community, if in fact something's labeled and recognized as genocide, it implies both a moral and a legal imperative that they need to do something about it, which is why nobody ever wants to actively use the word. And we've seen, before Darfur, all attempts to dissemble and not actually use the word genocide to talk about these events in the past. If you go, just on a sort of pragmatic basis, nobody wants to say that basically, the origins of their government and their country are bound up with acts of genocide. But for example, as I sit here in my office in the United States, it's a place where Native Americans used to live. They've been eradicated. They've been combined. They've been taken to reservations. They've been losing their language. Their high incidences, again, in terms of structural factors that disempower them and, again, leads to the fragmentation of these communities. The United States, right, exists in a situation of genocide that effectively is denied and forgotten. In the same way, in Turkey, who wants to remember that the origins of the modern Turkish state is bound up completely with genocide? Again, it's inconvenient and it muddies the sort of pure historical genealogy that all countries like to have. If your origin begins with genocide, it means that you have to actually confront something like this, and it doesn't make for good education in the schools, and that's among many other things. And I think, talking about education perhaps is something we need to talk about, because also in terms of different governments, when they teach about genocide in the United States, we used to celebrate Columbus Day. It still is celebrated. Right, but if you think about it, Christopher Columbus came in and was responsible directly or indirectly for the deaths of millions of Taino Indians. People don't want to talk about it, and education is one of the most important steps to rectifying denial and forgetting. And it's once if people engage and think about this, the hope is that in the future, when genocide is about to take place, people won't stand for it and they'll speak out.
Richard Dickmidgen.
The genocidal birth of modern Turkey is rarely, rarely mentioned. I read in The Nation a review of a book on the whole period from the Ottoman to the present period, and neither the author nor the book reviewer ever talked about the Armenians and all of the other minorities which were subject to genocide. There's new research now showing that various other Christian communities, Assyrians, Syriacs, Chaldeans, and others, and Greeks, Pontic Greeks, and other Greeks, were subject to genocide as well during 1915, before and after 1915 as well, way before what happened at Smyrna, that whole massacre under Mustafa Kemal himself. In fact, he was in town at that time. In addition to the Arabs, not only Christian Arabs, but Muslim Arabs, and Kurds. Of course, the Kurds were instrumental in killing Armenians as a part of Abdülhamid's Hamidiye units, but then also used by the Young Turks. But the Young Turks killed a lot of Kurds as well, maybe about 250,000. So that kind of violent birth the modern Turkish Republic, precisely because Turkey's geostrategic position and incredibly active diplomacy and massive amounts of money that Turkey, you know, spends on it. Genocide denial is a global business. And so many governments, including our own, and people who work in the government and may leave the government, become a part of this genocide denial process, starting with the Dulles brothers, by the way. The Dulles brothers, later on Secretary of State, but Dulles and his brother, Allen, the former head of CIA.
I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to The Scholar's Circle, and we are speaking with Alex Hinton, Dr. Richard Dekmecan, and Vahakan Dadrian. Turkey now, why is it so invested in the denial? Is it fear of reparations? Nobody's going to get prosecuted at this point. Nobody's alive anymore. Vahakan Dadrian.
First of all, before we explain that, I would like to add that in contradistinction to the Jewish Holocaust, there was massive popular participation in the Armenian Genocide, particularly the provincial peasant population actively engaged in massacres against local Armenian populations. And to understand this, we have to focus on a particular feature of the Armenian Genocide, namely the role of Islam. Islamic doctrines were energized. Of course, we know that, like the Nazi leaders, the Young Turk leaders, most of them were agnostics. They didn't believe in religion. But they went out of their way to sensitize, agitate, and incite the Muslim masses in the provinces against the Armenians. And here enters another factor into the picture, namely the possession, coming into possession of the accumulated wealth of the victim population. Peasants, ordinary peasants, became overnight ultra-rich people. There was a massive transfer of wealth from the victim to the perpetrator population. Now, to come to the problem of denial, why do the Turks persist in denial? I think there are three major reasons that need focal attention. One of them is that they have denied for almost 9 decades, and if the denial is overlooked and all of a sudden they accept the crime, they will look very foolish. Why? Why for 9 decades? In other words, it will compromise the integrity of successive generations of Turkish governments and leaderships in committing this denial. Secondly, when you deny, when you agree or accept the validity of the crime, there is the very serious critical issue of compensation. I think, in my judgment, one of the key reasons why the Turkish authorities persist in denying the crime is to avoid any possibility of compensating the Armenians. And the third one is, of course, if you acknowledge the crime, you have to engage in a massive revamping of the Turkish educational system. The entire history books have to be rewritten, and all the authors who have written books, Turkish historians, they will look foolish. In other words, the consequences for the authorities, for the government, for the people, for the Turkish nation is very grim.
If we want to talk about prevention, are there steps both with regular people and governments and institutions and non-governmental organizations that can be taken to make this actually never occur again? Richard Dekmecan.
There are some positive signs, but very little. Increasingly, very liberal and brave Turkish scholars have started using the genocide term to describe what happened to the Armenians at the risk of either getting killed in Turkey if they go back or being thrown into jail under Article 301, which is an infamous article. Now, of course, this is a small minority of very brave souls, mostly, by the way, living outside Turkey, Turkish scholars and Orhan Pamuk and other famous writers. But in case of the Obama administration, yes, it's going to be not well received by Turkey. They can threaten to do all kinds of things, as they tried to do to France. But after 6 months, they forget about it because Turkey needs the United States much more than the United States needs Turkey. This is what we don't seem to understand in this country. I'll stop.
Prevention. Professor Hinton.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Just to link it back again, I just want to make the point that one means of preventing genocide is to combat denial, because denial effectively perpetuates a genocide. So it's symbolic, but in fact it has very important repercussions to show other regimes that you can't do this. Recently, the sort of post-Rwanda, post-Bosnia, and now Darfur, there have been movements to develop different infrastructures, legal infrastructures, regional alignments. The concept of, for it's somewhat controversial, responsibility to protect is supposed to feed into us. But I think it's important, whatever the critiques are of some of these new infrastructures that have been built, to note that they didn't exist before. So we actually have new tools that have emerged that potentially can help, at least to some degree, in the prevention of genocide. But, you know, I think the importance of education cannot be underestimated, that there's a problem of awareness. You say, I sometimes get as a group of students, I say, what is genocide? Very few people have heard of the term. If you mention Pol Pot, many students have no idea who Pol Pot is. And if you mention other leaders who've been linked to genocide, education and awareness is absolutely critical because it enables citizens to speak out. But we shouldn't just think about, the countries like our own in the United States. But also it's important in countries where genocide has taken place, because one of the greatest predictors of genocide is past genocide and mass violence. So I think in general, there needs to be an engagement, an attempt to spread understanding and have dialogue be promoted, even as we develop these infrastructures.
Vaha Kandadrian, that gives you the last word.
Okay. In my judgment, prevention is intimately connected with punishment. History and record of punishment, and unfortunately, the record of punishment in relation to genocide is dismal in human history. And I think the Nuremberg is an exception. And even then, I believe that if the victims were only the Jews, I doubt whether we would have a Nuremberg trial. The problem that, as far as history is concerned, recent history, there has been no successful prosecution, significant prosecution of genocide. All perpetrators of post-World War II genocides have more or less escaped significant punishment.
Let me thank all three of you for joining us. Alex Hinton, Executive Director at the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. Professor Vaha Kandadrian, Director of Genocide Research at the Zorian Institute. And Dr. Richard Harayer Dekmejian, Professor of Political Science at University of Southern California and Founder and Director of USC's Institute of Armenian Studies. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at @armudian.